It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, there were a lot of stories in 2015 that made scientists rethink the evolution of our species. We'll talk about some of those stories with an editor from Discover Magazine.
First, on Friday, the University of Wisconsin System Board of Regents met and passed a two-page statement meant to reaffirm its commitment to freedom of expression and academic freedom, but some critics worry the statement might have unintended consequences.
Karen Herzog is with us to break down the story. She's a higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, you bet.
So UW Regents Friday signed the statement about academic freedom and freedom of expression. In a nutshell, what are they saying here?
Well, the idea is that around the country, several colleges and universities have established statements, policies, basically setting the stage for freedom of expression. There have been many protests on campuses. There have been all kinds of issues, such as concerns about trigger warnings, things that are, you know, students being made aware of something they might offend them before something is said or taught. There's a lot of racial tension on campuses and concern that universities haven't been places of open expression. There's another thing happening in the backdrop with UW system, and that is that a new 10-year policy is being discussed and worked out for faculty. And freedom of expression is one thing, but academic freedom is another. Both of those things have come up with concerns of faculty, whether their rights for academic freedom would be protected.
There's a lot of angles here, it sounds like. So is this mainly intended to protect faculty and staff from criticism over their public expressions and their academic research, or are students also included in these guidelines?
Oh, you're right. It's very complex. It's a combination. I think if you ask members of the Board of Regents who came up with this policy, they were saying that they were concerned about the fact that the 10-year policy is going to be developed in the next few months and finalized, and they wanted to reassure faculty that their academic freedom would be protected. But students, at the same time, it has come up with, like I said, the other issues around other campuses. Freedom of expression is something that has come up in Madison with some protests. The Black Lives Matter concerns about whether students are feeling welcome and included on campuses if they're students of color. So it is a number of things going on all at the same time.
There have been concerns about unintended consequences, people have pointed out. The ACLU, some student protest groups. What have we heard from them about worries about what this would do?
I think part of the concern here was that this policy was developed, frankly, kind of in the dark. It wasn't something that campuses knew about until last Monday, a few days before the Board of Regents met. Now, there were a couple of UW faculty members involved in the drafting of this, but it kind of came out of nowhere in terms of Regents not knowing that it was coming. There were a couple of members of the Board of Regents who were concerned that, gee, what are we trying to solve here? And the freedom of expression, has there been something on a campus here that's prompted it? No, you know, why do we want to put our position in writing? Because when you talk about unintended consequences, when you actually have things in writing, people can take that, you know, at face value and say, well, you said that, you know, X, Y, and Z in your statement, instead of it just being a general, hey, your rights for freedom of expression are protected. There are a couple of specific things that have been brought up by faculty, and the thing about it is there are some narrow exceptions to this statement, and one of them is, you know, if someone falsely defames a specific individual, whether it's a genuine threat or harassment, or something, this is an interesting one, otherwise directly incompatible with the functioning of the university. And the question on the minds of faculty is, well, who's going to determine this? And is this something that is really broadly open to interpretation? In that regard, somebody could take a position based on that statement and use it to their advantage.
Talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about new academic freedom and freedom of expression guidelines from the UW Regents. Want to pursue that last point, Karen, that idea of That sort of vague statement about the operation of the university. One thing that actually happened recently, a professor was tweeting with incoming students raising concerns about the university. Is there a worry that, hey, an administrator could look at that as actively interfering with the operation of the university?
I think that's a very legitimate concern, and that has been raised by faculty. And one of the things is that there's an expectation that faculty member who are speaking must say that they're speaking only on their own behalf, not the institution. So there's sort of a distancing of what they say, but at the same time, there's sort of this air of maybe someone could potentially be punished for what they say.
Now, there were student protesters at the Regents meeting there to see what was going to happen. There was going to be a meeting, I guess, between them and some administrators. Not clear to me whether that ended up happening or not. What were they looking for? What did they want to add to this conversation?
The students showed up at the Board of Regents meeting very quietly but visibly. They were dressed in black. They were carrying signs. And generally speaking, these were signs, you know, black and brown lives matter, signs concerning racism, concerns about racism and whether the institution, UW system, was addressing diversity concerns and inclusiveness. So they wanted to give a list of demands. And now these, they're referred to as urgent demands. Several campuses have had this type of thing happen. It's several dozen campuses have had students list demands to administrators on how they can be more inclusive, how they can improve the experience of students of color on these campuses. So the students attempted to speak. They wanted to read their demands during the Regents meeting, and the Regents president said, well, you know, we appreciate you being here. We respect what you have to say. We'll meet with you in private afterward. The student protesters wanted the media there. They wanted it to be an open discussion. They wanted to be able to hold system leadership accountable for whatever was said. And system leadership said, no, you can't record this. The media can't be present. This is a private conversation. So the students canceled that meeting.
And this is something that a lot of universities, as you mentioned, are navigating. There are these concerns, these protests about racism on campuses, unfriendly environments. And part of that unfriendly environment, a protester might say, is what a professor says. If they're saying something hostile or perceived as hostile to a minority group. And then this freedom of expression argument says, no, you've got to be really careful about limiting that. So this is a tough navigating act for the UW Regents here.
Right. It's something that there are fundamental arguments of, okay, what is the purpose of an education? And some would say that is to not only have your beliefs, but to be able to defend why you have them and to be able to really understand the other viewpoints. Now, if you're talking blatant racism or, you know, denial of the Holocaust or something like that, it gets really dicey in what constitutes harassment. And harassment is one of the things that is excluded from this freedom of expression statement. But basically, the statement says that, you know, it's not the university's role to attempt to shield individuals from ideas and opinions that they find unwelcome or even deeply offensive. So it's a very complicated scenario and one that universities, frankly, have had to navigate for the last few years, especially with politics on campuses and everything has changed so much with social media.
And as I understand it, before this meeting, UW System President Ray Cross said a few words about what's being done already for students of color in the UW system. What did he say?
Well, he was talking mostly about changes that had been made internally in administration and how the main point he made was that campus chancellors will be held accountable for improving overall enrollment of underrepresented minorities and their graduation rates, retention, all of these things. And then he basically talked about how he had, you know, changed responsibility for collecting some of this data, assigned it to a, like, Office of Institutional Research, basically just talking about how the leadership has responded to this need, but making it clear that chancellors will be held accountable for achievement gaps not being narrowed.
Well, Karen, we'll keep watching this one. I assume this is a conversation that will keep going for a while. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about the freedom of expression statement passed Friday at the UW Regents meeting.
Every Monday in December, we're looking back at the biggest science news of 2015, and today we're focusing on archaeology and paleontology. Our next guest says the theme for the past year is shaking up the family tree.
Gemma Tarlak is with us now to explain why. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, my fellow Homo sapiens.
Well, we are fellow Homo sapiens, but how we got to be that is looks a little different now than it did at the beginning of the year. How did we shake up the family tree in 2015?
Oh, my gosh. It's been such an exciting time to be in paleoanthropology for so many reasons. Just take, for example, our top 10 this year, top 10 most significant science stories. Two of them are key developments in paleoanthropology. And the first one you probably heard about, it's our number two story of the year, Homo naledi, found in this crazy South African cave that was kind of, you know, up the stairs, down the stairs, under a little chute. It was almost impossible to get to this tiny little chamber. But when they did, they found it was just absolutely chock full of bones. They have found more than 1,500 fossils in that tiny little area, and they're nowhere near done excavating. It's the biggest hominin fossil find, the biggest early Homo fossil find ever. It's so exciting.
And we're going to talk more about those early hominids in February, but in the meantime, looking at the Homo naledi, this discovery, what are some of the big lingering questions that have yet to be answered there?
Well, as exciting as it is that they found so many fossils, they're having a real problem dating them because, you know, they found all these fossils from this one species that they're calling Homo naledi, and usually when you find a bunch of hominid fossils, you've got, you know, the femur of an extinct antelope or a rock layer that's really easy to identify when it was set down. So you can really easily date them. Well, not easy. Nothing is easy in paleoanthropology, but comparatively, you can figure out pretty easily how old the actual fossils are. Unfortunately, in this chamber, there's no other material that they can use to base the date on. So they have to actually go in there and analyze chemical signatures of the fossils. Takes a lot longer. It's a lot trickier. So we have no firm date, which makes it really tantalizing. Where do these individuals fit in our family tree? We don't know.
This is one of the fun and frustrating things about science in general. You think, okay, we're going to make that next big discovery and it's going to answer our questions, when in fact, as we learned in this case, it often raises even more questions than we knew we had to begin with.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, on a side note, another scientist I was talking to about a story about the first farmers, he said his wife often asks him, hey, wouldn't you just want to go back in time and ask these people if they were intentionally sowing the seeds and harvesting them? And he said, no, that would take all the fun out of it. So, you know, it's one of the things that frustrates scientists, but it also keeps them so motivated.
Well, along these same lines, there's a story that you write about the oldest tools ever recorded. This is significant,
yeah,
too.
This is so tantalizing because, you know, we've got Homo naledi here, and it's a whole new species, no idea where it fits on the family tree. But we say to ourselves, oh, well, the genus Homo, to which we belong, as well as the Neanderthals, you know, we're all that. We're at the top of the food chain. We're the most advanced. We are the only tool makers around. If you're not a Homo genus member, you are not making tools. Well, this year, we found out that was a wrong idea. We found these tools, oldest stone tools ever. They're 3.3 million years old. Just for comparison, the previous oldest tools were 2.6 million years. So this is jumping way back about 600,000 years. And that's before the Homo genus was around. That's before our genus was around. So we don't know if maybe we're wrong about how old the Homo genus is, or were the Australopiths, who we generally think are our direct ancestors, were they not as primitive as we thought, and were they capable of making these stone tools?
Well, speaking of resetting the human calendar, an old jaw piece found apparently belonging to our genus, Homo, and it could show that we were a lot older than we had previously thought.
Yeah, not quite old enough to make those tools, but, you know, there's this huge gap in the fossil record, roughly from about 2.4 million years all the way back to 3.0 million years, where we really don't have any clues as to that crucial transition period between the earlier Australopiths and our own genus, Homo. But they did find this mandible, it's a partial mandible, partial jawbone in Ethiopia that's 2.8 million years old. So it's right in the middle of that kind of gray area where we don't know what was going on evolutionarily. And they are pretty sure by the shape of the teeth, by the pattern, by the way they're placed in the jaw, the shape of the jaw, they're pretty sure it's Homo. They have not named the species yet because they just have this one partial jawbone, but it's something they're going to be looking at, and it suggests that, you know, we kind of think the Homo genus goes back about 2.6 million years, maybe. Maybe it's older. Maybe it goes back even further, starting with this 2.8 million year old jawbone.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine. We're talking about the top science stories of the year. And again, this is an appetizer, Gemma. We're going to talk more about these early hominid fossils when we talk to you again in February. So we've been talking a little bit about maybe big questions, what it means to be human. And Chinese researchers have been editing human genes. And this has been an interesting story this year. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. And you know, this is a really intriguing thing because they're using a gene editing system called CRISPR-Cas9, and that has been around for more than a decade. Kind of it's continually refined, but what they did was they really crossed an ethical line that had never been crossed before that we know of. And these Chinese researchers took human embryos that were not viable. In other words, they would never have developed into fetuses. It was no way you could get a person born out of them. And they experimented trying to get rid of a hereditary blood disease by going in there, using the CRISPR system, changing the actual DNA in a way that had the individual been born and lived and procreated, the individual would have passed that genetic change on to its offspring. Now, this kind of research has been going on all the time for years in mice, in other lab animals, but there's always been this ethical line, like, we cannot do this with humans because that is opening a lot of doors that make people very uncomfortable, things like designer babies, just really absolutely changing really the foundations of our species and what it means to be human genetically. So that said, this experiment, which was released in April, they released the results. It was not successful, unfortunately. There were a lot of unintentional mutations introduced when they used the CRISPR system. So this is still very, very early work, but all the interest and all the discussion of the ethics involved spurred this entirely new way of looking and rethinking and basically saying, we are at a threshold. We need to get together, the international scientific community, and decide some rules, some regulations. And just last week, in fact, a three-day conference, international conference on gene editing wrapped up, and they're calling for more regulation. There's still a lot of debate whether they should be trying this at all on human embryos. But talking about the April experiment really kind of made people think, hey, this is not something we can put off till next year or the year after. This is something that's happening now. We need to get ahead of it and decide ethically what we want to do.
Another story where modern-day politics really is interacting with our human origins. ISIS and ISIL, of course, a great modern-day human toll, a lot of people dying. But also there's an archaeology angle, you write, in this top stories in science that we haven't heard as much about.
Yeah, and this is such a tragic story on so many fronts. But a longtime archaeologist, he's been an archaeologist in the Fertile Crescent area of Iraq and Syria for more than two decades. His name is Michael Dante, and he's now working with the State Department, figuring out ways of both preserving the incredible, incredible rich archaeological history and artifacts of the Iraq-Syria area, but he's also working on helping people document the destruction for future war crimes prosecutions. So really, ISIL, among, you know, they are horrible. They go in, they kill people, yes, but they are also razing, destroying, smashing a lot of priceless artifacts, and they are also selling them. They make a lot of money selling these things on the black market. And so by protecting our cultural heritage, protecting the cultural heritage of people living there in Iraq and Syria, it's really a way of protecting their identity, but it's also a way of cutting into the bottom line for ISIL and making it a little more difficult for them to finance their campaign of destruction.
And we're going to wrap up talking about, again, this has been an incredibly busy year in the archaeology field. What news are you expecting in 2016? There's some big stuff on the horizon.
Oh, yeah. I'm not just expecting it in 2016. I'm expecting it any second now. You know, I check my little cheat sheet alert box a couple times a day. But you may have heard that there's a British archaeologist who thinks he has discovered Nefertiti's tomb in the Valley of Kings. This would be huge because it's never been found, which means it may never have been looted. And he thinks it's actually hidden behind King Tut's tomb. And he has some really tantalizing clues about that, including just the shape of King Tut's tomb. It's actually the shape of a female pharaoh's tomb, which is kind of odd. And it's a little bit smaller than it should be based on his stature and his society standing. So they think actually it may be Nefertiti's tomb that they converted at the last minute and made it kind of a two-for-one tomb special and stuck King Tut in there too. So it could be absolutely huge because there's so much, you know, lore and legend about Nefertiti. But also, if we could find an unpillaged, unlooted tomb of an ancient Egyptian ruler, wow, right?
Yeah, and you're expecting that any day?
Yeah, they started. He mentioned his theory early in the year over the summer. The Egyptian government gave him permission to do some scanning, some non-invasive scanning. It was very positive. He thinks that it's more evidence supporting his theory. Basically, now they've got to go in invasively. And I'm sure they're not going to take like a sledgehammer to the tomb, but they're going to, you know, try to figure out if there are these fake doors or real doors that have been covered over with fake walls and stuff. And they're doing that right now.
Sounds incredibly exciting. You're going to keep us up on that. Gemma, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlek, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. From the September 11th attacks to the shootings in San Bernardino, California, terrorism has loomed large in the minds of the American public and policymakers. From counterterrorism programs here in the United States to military and intelligence operations around the world, billions of dollars were spent each year, as much as $1 trillion overall since the September 11th attacks.
From one perspective, that's money well spent. The risk of terror attacks, especially in the worst-case situations of a nuclear attack or other weapons of mass destruction, could justify wide-ranging efforts to keep Americans safe.
But our next guest says when you weigh the risks of terrorism against the amount we spend trying to prevent it, we end up wasting a lot of money, often with little or no benefit to the public.
John Mueller joins us now. He's a political scientist at The Ohio State University and at the Cato Institute. He's co-author of the new book called Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, lay out your basic argument that we're spending too much on counterterrorism based on a misperception of risk.
Yeah, substantially. The issue mostly is that after 9/11, tons of money was thrown at the problem in an emotional and sort of panicky way, which is hardly easily understood. But eventually, you should probably get around to waking up and saying some of that money was probably spent well, some of that money was probably spent badly, and try to shift money from the bad projects to the good ones. And for the most part, that hasn't been done. So our studies are, with Mark Stewart and myself, have been trying to apply cost-benefit analysis to terrorism the way you would apply it to other safety measures to deal with other kinds of hazards.
And you make the case in the book that in part because of that strong emotional impact you mentioned, that we overestimate the risk of a terrorist attack, of an attack affecting us personally.
Yeah, the place to begin is not are we safer, but how safe are we? And using the history of terrorism over the last 30 years, in America, including 9/11 and the count, however, an American's chance of being killed by a terrorist is about 1 in 4 million per year. If you only deal with the period since 9/11, it's about 1 in 110 million per year. That doesn't stop the discussion. That's actually where it should start. And those kinds of numbers are simply not given out. And the issue is, if it's 1 in 4 million, is that safe enough? Well, maybe it's not. But how much safer do we want to be, and how much do we want to spend money on? How do we want to spend money to make it even lower?
And it isn't necessarily just how we spend that money, whether this program's effective and this program less so, but how much? There's a point where, given that risk you laid out, maybe it's just too much money for only a slight improvement in our safety, or maybe no improvement at all.
Yes, that's exactly right. If the question is how much do we want to spend to try to reduce probabilities of a terrorist attack or of damage, make it even lower than it is now. And that's the kind of discussion that should be there. The issue basically is one that you never hear politicians or administrators talk about, which is acceptable risk. At some point, people decide that the risk is so low that they'd rather not spend money on making it even lower, but rather spend it on things which are causing a huge amount of damage. And so consequently, since everybody has limited funds, the issue would be to try to spend the money on things that reduce risk at relatively low cost and not spend lots of money that reduce risk at very high costs. It's a very obvious thing, unless you have infinite budgets, and no one is in that position, obviously.
But in the back of our minds, especially probably since 9/11, is the fear of a worst case, something even worse than 9/11, even if it's a very small probability, the chance of, you know, a terrorist nuclear attack in a crowded metropolis, say. The outcome there is so bad that maybe it's worth spending a lot to prevent that, again, low probability incident from happening.
Well, yes, we could also be hit by a meteor and the whole country and the whole world blown up. You have to keep these things in perspective. You do want to worry about the worst-case scenario, and how bad can it get, but you don't want to base your entire policy position on simply dealing with that kind of situation. There are a lot of bad things that can happen. Some things happen very frequently, like automobile accidents, and your chance of being killed in an automobile accident is about 1 in 8,000 per year, not 1 in 4 million per year. And so that's the kind of analysis that should be there. At some point, spending more on it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That kind of analysis has not been done for the most part, mainly because of the fears you mentioned.
Talking to political scientist John Mueller. He's co-author of the new book, Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. You in the book, John, compare the current worry about Islamist-inspired or related terror to the Red Scare of the Cold War, a witchcraft panics in centuries before that. Are we thinking in a state of panic now as we make these policy decisions?
Yes, very often, and it's understandable when something really, you know, like 9/11 happens, but eventually you should get sobered up. We frequently do that in our private lives or our business lives, you know, overcompensate for something, but eventually you want to recalculate. That has basically not been done. The programs just keep continuing on and on. So that's what we're trying to do in the book, is to say, look, these programs actually probably do reduce risk at a really quite acceptable cost, but there's other programs, for example, the federal air marshals, which cost an incredible amount of money, about $1 billion a year, reduce risk extremely little for that huge expenditure.
Well, I want to look at an attack like the one in San Bernardino, a lone wolf or two lone wolves, I guess we could say. People are saying this would be very hard to have seen coming in advance and prevent. I mean, is there such a thing as a cost-effective way to try to stop that kind of attack before it happens?
Well, we try to do that quite a bit in this book about policing of terrorism to see how many attacks would have to be prevented to justify the expenditures. It obviously, like any adult, you should realize that people should realize that basically you can't have perfect security. You can't have perfect security against lightning. You can't have it against various automobile accidents and a million other things. But what you can do is try to reduce the risk. And that's the kind of calculation that's simply not really put in measure. Basically, what happens is the vast majority of programs that get put in place simply continue, because if you remove them, then you must be actually increasing the risk a little bit. And the real issue, obviously, is you want to move things from the expensive programs that don't reduce risk very much to ones that reduce risk at a smaller cost.
Is there some value in making us feel safer, if reducing our perception of risk? And if so, does that justify some of the expenditures on highly visible programs that we see when we go to the airport, say?
Yeah, they sometimes called security theater. And if being afraid is a cost. Being afraid is a perfectly reasonable reaction if you're walking through a jungle and you're approached by a saber-toothed tiger. The correct response is not to go up to the cat and see how and admire his teeth. It's to run like crazy. So fear is actually a good thing. That's one of the reasons the human race still survives. But fear also takes a toll, and what you want to do is get the fears right and correct. You don't want to be afraid of things that aren't much of a problem. Now, we have a chapter actually on public opinion in the book on terrorism. And somewhat, I must say, to my surprise, there have been virtually no changes since 9/11. And, for example, the number of people who say they worry that they or a member of a family might be killed is about 40%, even though their chance of being killed is 1 in 4 million. And do you really want to spend time worrying about something that's that small on an individual basis? And that was the case even before the rise of ISIS in the last year or so. And it's also that we spent tons of money. You talked about security theater, essentially. The increase of expenditures on just homeland security in the United States, not including the fighting overseas or anything, is about $1 trillion. That's an increase since 9/11. The polls clearly show, even before ISIS rose, that there had been no change in people saying they feel safer. So if these programs are designed to make people feel safe, there's no evidence from the polls whatever that they've been successful in that area.
And in the realm of costs of counterterror programs, you don't just in the book look at financial costs, that's a big part of it, but also some policy costs, things like civil liberties. And I wanted to ask you, in the news since that San Bernardino attack, you have a candidate, a front-running candidate right now, like Donald Trump, saying one approach he would favor is stopping all Muslims from coming into the country for a period of time. Do you see that as a cost, a non-beneficial cost?
Yes, when you're dealing with the costs of counterterrorism measures or the costs of terrorism, you have to include bad policies as part of that. I mean, if you want to count the 9/11, the cost of the multi-trillion-dollar war in Iraq, obviously the cost has been extremely high, and that was not caused by the terrorists but by the counterterrorists. In fact, in general, the most cost-effective counterterrorism measure is to not overreact. In other words, not punish yourself and do what the terrorists are unable to do for themselves. So those are the kinds of calculations that should be there. When you're dealing with a terrorist attack, you do not simply deal with the loss of life, the cost of the direct cost of or some semi-direct costs of the terrorist attack would include not only people being killed and property damage, but also the cost of increased fears and the cost of ill-advised policies, such as frequently occur in the civil liberties area.
We're talking to John Mueller. He's co-author of the new book, Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. He says our spending on counterterrorism efforts is way out of line with the actual risks and doesn't necessarily make us much safer in reality or make us feel safer.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think we overstate the risks of terrorism here in the United States and that we overspend to prevent it? Or do you feel like the potential risks justify the amount that we do spend? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with political scientist John Mueller, co-author of the new book, Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. He says the time, the money, and effort the United States spends on counterterrorism is way beyond the amount justified by the actual risk.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we're spending too much on counterterrorism? Do you think we're in a state of panic, not making smart decisions? Or do you think that past terror attacks, the potential for more and bigger threats, justifies most of our counterterrorism efforts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Betsy on the line in Fitchburg. Betsy, hi.
Hi. This is such perfect timing. This evening at my kids' school, they're having a meeting with parents about security. And already are rumors flying that they're going to recommend armed guards at the door and everything. And I'm wondering if the guests could give any words of wisdom on how to talk to people when they're in panic.
Betsy, thanks for the call. So that goes a little, I mean, Islamist-inspired terror, but also school shootings in the United States on a lot of people's minds. My kids do code red drills at their school. How do we assess costs and benefits, you know, when risks to kids are involved?
Well, the place to start is with trying to figure out how safe we are at this point. If you use the statistics since in this century for what is called, the FBI calls active shooters, this kind of shooters, particularly at schools, of course, one's chance of being killed per year is about 1 in 9 million. Now, that you can say that, and it doesn't necessarily cause people to be happy or anything, or quiet, or get away from panic, but they should know the number. It's not clear that kind of. I've been trying, of course, since 9/11, basically, to use this kind of language and cause people to tone down, and it mostly does not work. People say, "Well, okay, it's 1 in 9 million, or 1 in 4 million, or 1 in 110 million." I'm still afraid, but they should know the number. and the number is basically not out there. In the case of terrorism, there's only been one case in which an official has said, get a life, your chance of being killed is about the same as being killed by lightning. And that was Mayor Bloomberg in New York in 2008. And that was the only, time basically that any official has actually said that. Now it seems to me it should be there. It should be in the newspapers. It should be in every report on terrorism. San Bernardino took place, but keep in mind that your chance of being killed by a terrorist is about 1 in 4 million per year, and it's simply not out there. Given my look at these public opinion, it's not clear that that would necessarily change people's opinion, but it ought to be there. At any rate, whether they have a calming effect or not, and I'm not very optimistic, as you can see, at least the number should be there instead of people just reacting hysterically, saying, well, I could be next. What tends to happen is people, it's sort of like the lottery in reverse. In the case of the lottery, your chance of winning is very small. But, of course, your chance of winning is the same as everybody else's, which is totally irrelevant. The point of this is what the chance is, not whether what everybody else's chance is. And I think that happens sometimes with terrorism as well. When it seems basically random, as it certainly did with the Santa Barbara case, people tend to say, well, it could be me. I have as good a chance of being killed as anybody else, so they're afraid. But the real thing is not, could it be, is it random? But what is the probability?
Betsy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with John Mueller, political scientist at Ohio State University, co-author of the book Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, looking at the risks of terror attacks and the costs of counterterrorism. Go back to our callers with Oscar on the line in Milwaukee. Oscar, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
What do you think?
I would like to say, actually comparing numbers, there are approximately 480,000 people who die annually due to cigarette smoking. Now, that is a huge number. 480,000 people die annually every single year. And comparing that number to potential terrorist attacks, I think the numbers are significantly low when it comes to compared to terrorism.
Oscar, thanks a lot for that call. And John, part of the cost-benefit analysis you want to make is to say maybe $1 billion you spend on counterterrorism might be more cost-effective in, smoking prevention or automobile crashes or cancer prevention or you name it, and having to compare those two and make the justification for what we spend where.
Well, that's what should be being done by officials, and they simply don't do it when terrorism is in the mix. Even though they do it with things that are very emotional, such as nuclear reactors and nuclear radiation and so forth, in some cases air pollution. So there are some areas where a lot of emotions are involved, they nonetheless are able to do it. In terrorism, that's not the case. The issue basically is if you spend a huge amount of money to save a very few lives, then you can't spend it on other areas which might save a lot more lives for the same price or even for a lower price. So it has to be there. And again, the place to start is with how safe are we now? And do we really want to spend more to make ourselves even safer from that when there are things which are killing a large number of people, such as obviously smoking or driving in cars? In the case of driving cars, we basically do accept a huge cost for having cars. About 40,000 people die every year. Now, virtually all of those people would be not killed had we simply adopted a simple plan, which would be to change the speed limit for private passenger automobiles to 13 miles an hour. With certainty, you can say that something like 30,000, 40,000 people who are now living, some of them may even be listening to this program, will be dead unless who would be killed in an automobile accident would not be if that program is put through. So if you're against that, what you're saying is, well, 30,000, 40,000 lives is worth it because we get all the advantages of automobiles, and that argument is not being made. So we constantly have to make that decision. Let me give you another example which might be helpful. Several years ago, the authorities had to decide whether they wanted to put seat belts in the back seats of cars. And they had to go through this sort, same sort of analysis. Well, the back seats of cars, there usually aren't people in the back seats, so, you know, protecting people, you know, in accidents is not as important as obviously protecting the driver who's always in the car. And also the back seat is comparatively safe compared to the front seat. You're not slammed into the windshield generally. And so they went through the thing, and they basically came to the conclusion that on balance, putting seat belts, forcing people to put seat belts in the back seat of the car was a good idea in the case of new cars, but not old cars. In other words, they said, if you're driving around in the back seat of an old car and you get killed in an accident that could have been prevented by a seatbelt, too bad, you're just going to have to die. That's the way they didn't put it that way, needless to say, but that's effectively what they were saying. And the difference is not that they thought that people who drive around in the back seats of old cars are morally less desirable than people who drive ride around in the back seats of new cars, but because the cost of a security measure is considerably different. The cost of putting seatbelts in a new car is fairly small because it's done in the manufacturing process. The cost of putting seatbelts in the back seat of cars, of old cars, is quite costly because you have to go back and retrofit, essentially. So what they're saying is that in the case of new cars, the reduction of risk is worth the relatively small cost of putting seatbelts in the back seats of cars, but it's not worth it in something else. In other words, instead of spending the money on retrofitting a huge number of old cars, we'd rather spend the money on something else. So that's the kind of decision you have to make. And you're essentially saying, well, some people are going to die because they could have had seatbelts in the back seats of old cars, but we're not willing to spend that kind of money. We'd rather spend it on something else. That's the kind of straightforward process that ought to be gone through.
We'll leave it there. John, thanks for joining us today. That was John Mueller, political scientist at The Ohio State University and at the Cato Institute. We've been talking about the new book. He's the co-author. It's called Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. Check out Google today, their homepage, and you'll see a guy doing some yoga postures. That's what they are if you're a non-yogi like me and you're a little confused at first.
That's right. Today would have been the 97th birthday of VKS Iyengar, an Indian Swami who popularized postural yoga in this country and paved the way for an America where more people than you think you might expect to. They know things like sun salutation or a warrior pose or how to do a tree. Even you, Rob Ferret. Could do a tree, I think.
I'm not that much of the yoga thing, but tree sounds pretty easy. Can you talk me through it? Because you do some yoga, or you have done.
I do some postural yoga.
And so, postural yoga, this is what we think of, like when there's a person, they're in a pose.
Right, I mean, there's yoga meditation as well, which is more what I do, but postural yoga is very popular, you know, the yoga pants, all those things like that. So, I don't know. That's all
part
of
yoga,
this.
I have lots of the yoga pants. I just don't do the yoga.
So you're halfway there. What you need to do for your tree is you stand on one foot.
Okay.
You put the other foot.
This is radio yoga.
You are doing it. Okay, so you put your other leg. Put your foot up on your thigh as high as you can go comfortably.
On the same? Okay, wait, the opposite.
Uh-huh, and now you raise your arms above your head. Whoa!
Hey!
That's not a bad tree.
Johnny Yoga.
It's kind of a weird-looking tree, but it's a tree.
Well, I'd probably do this with my shoes off, actually. Now I have a footprint on my pants.
I applaud that.
All right, well, share your love of yoga or not on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR, your favorite pose, I guess.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.